we are going to get a group together to go see that. It's going to be awesome. Thanks everybody for coming out. Can I get a hand raise on how many people were in New York last year when we got together? I don't know what percent that is, but that's good. How I want to introduce this quick is to think about last year. Last year was the first time that we got together, real life, Second Life meetup. We did it in New York. We got 150 people all together for one day of discussions about Second Life. And this is amazing. The virtual world is feeding back on me. We had 150 people get together. Second Life had 60,000 users at that time. I came prepared with these little dinky graphs that kind of showed how it had been growing, and there it was at 60,000 people, and kind of projected this line, will it hit either 100,000 or 200,000, or what are we going to get? That was about 10 months ago, I guess. Feels like yesterday. As you know, Second Life has had lots of growth in that time, and we kind of scaled this event up accordingly. We look forward to doing it again and more things like this next year. So this is really your time to have fun at this conference, at this convention, obviously. Meet people that you may have known in Second Life already or not. And to learn as much as you can from everybody here. We obviously have a really diverse group of interests or reasons why people are here. Some people are interested in the business side. They want to be entrepreneurial in Second Life. Some people are there because they like to have fun or just be creative. And we have all these schools coming together here, so you've got to take advantage of that. To introduce myself, my name is Jerry Papendorf. My Second Life avatar name is Snoopy Brown Zamboni. I work with the Electric Sheep Company, so I'm getting to live a little bit of my dream here, getting to make my living working with really talented people who are doing things in the metaverse, doing things inside of Second Life. The co-host here this afternoon with me is Justin Bovington. Justin, who are you?
I'm Justin Bovington. Good morning. As many of you know, Jerry and myself are part of eSheep and a company called Rivers Run Red. And so, but first and foremost, we're Second Life people. That's probably the most important thing. And I think it's probably the thing about this year's convention is the word community, and this is what we're here to celebrate more than anything else. And I just want to add something about the statistics, is that Corey just reliably informed me, as my fact checker, on the penalty of death, if it was wrong. But in 2004, it was 14,000 people in October. 2005, it was 59,000. And today, as in up to this last minute, it's 536,444, which I think deserves a round of applause for the efforts that the guys have done this year. And I think if it goes this way, it's going to be Vegas next year. And just like SL, what happens in SL stays in SL. So,
obviously not. I wanted to make sure that we thank everybody who worked on this convention. Last year, I worked really closely with the team to help set up, and this year, there were a few people who just really ran ahead and did the legwork. We have Flipper Peregrine on stage right now. And then on the Lindenlab side, because they've been so supportive of the event, it wouldn't be possible to do without them and the support that they've given it, financial as well as just labor power, people to work on it and help us organize everything. So where's Jessica Linden at? Then to run through a few names real quick and make a small announcement that's of relevance to where the SLCC is going to go in the future. Also worked very closely with Nexius Vital, Physic, Misty Rhodes, Validiza Anubis, Nethermind Bliss, and Driftmon. And Nexius was instrumental in actually putting together a nonprofit organization. Jennifer Flipsway. Sorry, you're here. And we've actually just incorporated as a nonprofit organization that is going to have some weight and hopefully bring in people and be able to get added resources to continue to scale this event up so there might be thousands next year. We don't really know. So we invite your input on that. If you're having fun here, if you enjoy the event, we know we've got a lot of interest. So how do we handle all those interests when you get to town? What can we do next year? How can we make it better? Now, obviously, we're not only just in this room right now. We have a whole in-world component to this conference. A lot of people couldn't make it here today, so we're here to talk about Second Life and how we're using it and where it's going. So obviously, we have this in-world component. And I'm going to hand the microphone over to Flip for a second to talk about how that was handled this year and who all's there and how that's working.
Hey, in-world. Whoa. Hello, everyone in San Francisco, and hello, everyone in-world. We're glad you could all join us either in real life or virtually. And the way we set up the in-world convention was actually pretty cool this year. Obviously, we're getting to the size now and interest level where, you know, throwing a couple sims together really doesn't do it justice. So what we did this year, we had four regions which were generously donated by Linden Lab, quite beautiful. Be sure to check them out if you haven't. And we've got the audio streams and video streams running there. But we've also just handed out the video URL so people can host throughout the grid as a whole. And I wanted to thank a couple people especially. I wanted to thank Eggie and Moon Adamant for throwing together the stadium at the Four Corners. And I wanted to thank Infinite Vision and Out of Bounds Software for putting together the remote viewer, which Torley was kind enough to distribute. I figured out the best way to distribute something in SL yesterday, by the way. I am Torley, give him the object, and suddenly it's all over the grid. I mean, that that kind of personifies viral marketing. So, but so I wanted to give a big shout out to Torley, Out of Bounds, Infinite Vision for putting that together, and Eggie and Moon is not here to see. If you manage to make it in-world, be sure to do a bird's eye view of the stadium too, and you'll notice it looks just like a flower, so there's kind of a beautiful garden there. It really came out looking nicely as part of the overall region. Also, just wanted to give another big thank you to our sponsors, for those of you who weren't here last night and heard me singing the sponsor song. just wanted to make sure we thank the sponsors again. Without them, this really wouldn't be possible. The rate we actually charge people, while it may seem like a lot of cash, is quite a bit less than it actually costs us per person. And without the sponsors, there's no way we could have done that. So thank you very much to all our sponsors. Be sure to visit their builds in world. Be sure to give them a pat on the back if you see them around at the convention. And we hope you sponsors all decide to come for the ride again next year. Thank you all very much. In world people, feel free to create a little chaos while we do our bit up here on stage. We'll watch you flying around on the screen. Thank you very much. Thanks all for coming. You guys are great.
We get started with the program very shortly. One last thank you to the sponsors who paid in. Linden Lab, Electric Sheep Company, Rivers Run Red, Luskwood, Nominee, and Stroker's Toys were the leading sponsors in this year's event and really allowed us to make this happen. Now, you've got, here's your... If you don't have one of these, get one. During the course of the day, you can grab me, or you can grab Justin, you can grab Flip, or you can grab other people who identify themselves as volunteers. Tell us stuff if you've got questions. If you see something you'd like to see, just do it. I'm going to turn it over now to Justin, who's going to be showing us the machine. I'm going to start the day before we get into our first presentation on a keynote by Mr. Kapoor. So, Justin, what do you got?
Okay, and when we sat down about 2 weeks ago in Skype, Jerry and I, we tried to summarize what it means to be in Second Life. And of course, we went through the technology, scripting stuff, and all the great objects that we actually made. And one thing that it always came back to is always about people. And some of you I know have seen this, especially the guys in England who watched it last week, but we produced a series of films for Channel 4, which were, we worked on for 6 months, making sure they got our story right and got it correct. So we decided to actually show you three of those instead, because we think they probably tell the story better. So I'm going to hand over to the videos themselves.
It's really kind of a thrill when you first start that people actually want to pay for things you make, that they value enough these pixels that you've created to spend money on. My ideas and the quality of what I create. They're adding to the beauty of their world. my business, I wasn't earning a lot of money. I was making maybe $200 a month. So the way that it's grown, I mean, in just a year and 3 months, it's grown many-fold, and now I'm making more like $1,000 a week. I have no manufacturing costs. I don't need suppliers. I don't need distributors. I just get an idea in my head. I build it once, and even though each individual item isn't sold for very much, I can make a lot of money off of one item. Chris and I met because I was looking for my first plot of land. The surroundings were beautiful, and I decided here was where I was going to settle. Eventually, we did meet as neighbors, and we kind of got crushes on each other, and kind of knew we did. After a short while, we decided we would go for a relationship.
As the technology gets better, which is already doing, become second nature, be a natural way of connecting and being with people, so that it will really become just as much a valid way of being as it is to be in the real world for us.
He's an early investor in Linden Lab, and when I was poking around last night doing my research, my due diligence on Mitch, I found something kind of looked kind of interesting, that Linden Lab and Second Life is currently his only for-profit venture that he's doing, which I think is interesting that he has this kind of spirit, and he's getting behind Second Life. So he's going to talk about how the triumph of personal computing, the success of computers going everywhere and us using them, what that says about the future of Second Life. So if we could welcome Mitch up here.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. I was so moved by those films. If I break up a little bit, you'll forgive me, but it's emotional. I have about 45 minutes. I'm going to try to leave a few minutes at the end for Q&A. And I really want to do two things here. I want to try to interweave some of my story, how I got to where I am, my personal history with technology, with computers, and with Linden Lab and virtual worlds and Second Life. And I'd also like to try to speculate about some of the larger meaning of it all and where we are going or where we might be going. And to do that, I'm going to try to draw on some of the things that I've learned in 25 years of working with very early stage disruptive technologies that have grown from nothing to be very, very big things like the personal computer and the internet. A little bit of personal history here. I'm a child of the 60s. I came of age in the 1960s and went to college. And the first job I had after college was as a disc jockey. So my parents, who had paid for my Ivy League education, were not all that thrilled with it. But I was making $115 a week and all the records I could eat at WHCN-FM in Hartford, progressive rock radio station. And during the 70s, as preparation for my career as a technology entrepreneur, I did a number of things, and in particular, I was a meditation teacher for several years. I resonated with the last movie. The last job I had was as a mental health worker in a psychiatric hospital. And one day, I realized I could make a tremendous contribution to the field of human services by getting out of it. So I bought an Apple II computer in 1978, at the very, 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 very beginning. It was so far back that the day I bought it, they still didn't have a disk drive for it. The only means of mass storage was an audio tape cassette. And the thing that transformed personal computers, in my view, from something for hobbyists to something that had demonstrated the potential of huge real-world impact, was a program called VisiCalc, a screenshot of which is up here on the right. Some of you know what it is, I bet a lot of you don't. It was actually the first electronic spreadsheet, and it was invented by this gentleman named Dan Bricklin. So I get to make a little correction to the online program that described me. I'm not the inventor of the spreadsheet. This is Dan Bricklin was the inventor of it. But Lotus 1-2-3, which we developed and brought to market, was indeed the application that really drove the personal computer to be ubiquitous in the early 1980s on the IBM PC. And I founded, designed the product, and I was the CEO of the company through a period of hypergrowth from zero to 2,000 employees in less than 3 years, and zero in revenue to hundreds of millions in revenue. And that gave me a lot of experience about the business side of managing very high growth tech companies. So in the middle, that's me in the yellow shirt back then, 20 years ago. The guy on my left in the red shirt is Fred Gibbons, who was another entrepreneur. I'm not sure what happened to the guy in the blue shirt on my other side. Well, all right, let's try to have a little tiny bit of theoretical framework here to talk about new technologies and what happens with them. By the way, I've stolen all, borrowed all of these images from the internet, and at some point, somebody is probably going to say, do you have copyright rights to this stuff? And that would provoke a very interesting conversation about the future of intellectual property. The technology adoption curve, many or most or all of you are familiar with this. Anytime there is something dramatically new that comes along, you always have a very small number of early adopters who get on board with it first. And then if there is merit and value as that technology improves its capabilities and reduces itself in price, and as the people who work with it figure out how to use it to deliver more value, you get a second wave of people coming in who are pragmatists. They are not enthusiasts, but they early on spot the value of that new thing and begin to find ways of using it. Following that, there's a large block of, I'm not sure I'd use the word conservatives here, but it was on the thing that I stole from the net, decided not to change it, who are people who, because they're in the mainstream and the mainstream is converting to use whatever that new technology is, they come along. And then finally, there's always a small set of laggards who are trailing edge, and they're the last to adopt. Okay, so on the technology adoption curve, I'm about 4 standard deviations to the left of the early adopters. Been doing this for a long time. That's me also in 1982, as we were bringing out Lotus 1-2-3. But more than a business guy, I'm really an enthusiast, you know, and a geek, which is because I love playing with this new stuff. And that's actually how my career started. I was really obsessed with personal computers. And just in the same way that it has been possible for many people to join in and become a resident in Second Life, it doesn't cost money. You don't have to have anybody's permission to do that. You know, you need, you know, internet access and a capable computer. But other than that, the barriers to entry are extraordinarily low. And that was also the case with the personal computer. It was the first time that it was possible for an ordinary individual who did not have an institutional connection of any kind to get their hands on computing technology, because prior to that point, they were extraordinarily expensive and large and in universities and corporate computing centers. There was a very, very, very sharp dividing line. And then it all changed. And that's the first observation that I would make, is it is very difficult to remember a time, even if you were alive then, when people did not have huge amounts of computing power at their fingertips. But I can assure you that was an extraordinarily radical idea, and I'll talk about that more. But the same thing now goes for virtual worlds. It's still a very radical idea that these are somehow going to be important and mainstream, and it's still only a very small fraction of the world's population that understands and appreciates that. And we here are in that number. And we are very early. We are the early adopters. And I want to talk about what that means and the challenges and the opportunities of that. Here's a list of disruptive technologies that I've been involved with. We talked about the PC. We'll talk a little bit about the internet. Streaming media, and I'll talk about that. And social production here, I'm referring to things like the Wikipedia, which is, other than Second Life, the other most interesting thing which is going on today. Virtual worlds, and some people speculate that there is an oncoming disruptive technology called the singularity. Ray Kurzweil wrote a book about that. However, that's outside of my metaphysics, and if you want to hear about that, you'll have to go hear Ray talk. We're going to get as far as virtual worlds, but not any further. So these are our use cases and our case studies. And we'll be coming back to these. Okay. a little bit about the history of virtual worlds. How many people know who this is? Could I see hands, please? It's pretty good, about half of you. That's great. This is Jaron Lanier. If there was a single figure that you had to pick out of an inventor and technologist who deserves credit for virtual worlds, he would probably be Jaron. He coined the term virtual reality. He had an early company called VPL that back in the late 80s had virtual reality systems. And he actually introduced me to virtual reality. I was fortunate back then to be able to put the goggles on and the glove and to, in those days, to get something that was orders of magnitude worse looking and performing than Second Life today required at least $500,000 of hardware on some fancy SGI system. And it for me was a transformative experience. So I have my thanks to Jaron, because experientially, that first time I levitated, I flew around and I landed on a lily pad, I kind of got it that there was something incredibly important, and that reality was not ultimately defined by bricks and mortar and atoms, but anything that was convincing enough could be real. And I understood that, and that was something very experiential. The other important thing about Jaron to know is that he's a pioneer in technology marketing, and I continue to believe that dreadlocks can be a very important tool in branding and recognition. So, I'm sorry this is blurry. This is an early picture of Philip Rosedale and me. Back in the early days of Linden Lab, this is actually on Linden Street, taken there, I think this ran in Newsweek. And I want to talk a little bit about our relationship and how we got started, because it's part of the early history of the company. I met Philip in the mid-1990s. I had been involved with a company called Real Networks that was really the first company to successfully do streaming media, real audio, real video. And I was the first outside investor in that company and sat on the board. And Philip had a very small two-person company doing interesting early stuff with video conferencing over the internet. And that little company was bought by Real Networks, I think mainly to be able to get access to Philip's talents. And Philip came and worked there and helped bring, was a general manager for Real Video and then the CTO. And I got to know him, not well, but we met there. He would come and present at board meetings. But where I got to know him was a few years later, in 1999, for a brief period of time, our trajectories both brought us to an organization called Accel Partners, which was a Silicon Valley venture capital firm. I had been doing angel investing for many years, and in 99 moved to California and decided to see what life was like as an institutional venture capitalist. I can tell you it was terrible for me. It did not work, but it was an interesting time. And Philip had come and was an entrepreneur in residence there, hatching new ideas. And we bonded. And I think the reason we bonded is, despite the fact that our roles were different, we were both the new guys and kind of outsiders in this very strange kind of world. So we would sit next to each other and whisper disrespectful things about what was going on in whatever meeting we were, we were in. And Philip had the idea of what became Second Life back then, and actually pitched it to the partners at Accel Partners, not once, but multiple times, and was turned down each and every time. We can talk about that, and I will. But I said to Philip, so when you go off and start your thing, which I think you're going to do, when you're ready, come see me, because I'd like to help. I'd like to be involved. Part of the satisfaction that I get is helping entrepreneurs start their companies and being a bit of a mentor and sharing what I know. I think in part because I wished when I was starting my company there had been more mentoring available. But plus, it's fun. It's stimulating and fun, and interesting. The proceeds help fund the nonprofit work that I do. And that was the beginning. And Philip went off, and a few months later came back, and had been working with one other guy at the very, very foundational first few elements of what eventually became Second Life. And I came and put some money in and went on to the board. And that was, I can't even remember, I think it was 6 years ago, but it was really the very, very, very beginning. And we have been working together ever since. So I'm the board chair. I think I'm the largest single shareholder. I have a fairly big stake in the outcome. But more than anything, I'm an enthusiast and a fan and a supporter and a believer and an advocate, and think that there is something extraordinarily important going on here. And it's not just about the company, it's about what's being created, it's about the community and the innovation and the ways that this will be transformative. So it's a fabulous thing. And I'm going to talk just for one, maybe two slides about the business side of things, and then we're going to talk about what does it mean and where is it going. As a startup, Linden has been very interesting because at the outset, it was just not clear what it was going to take to make it be successful. Technically, extraordinarily ambitious. Nobody had done anything like this before in many respects. And we agreed that what we needed was a long runway. If you think of a business being like an airplane, and you need to be able to be in the air at the end of the runway, when you don't know how long it is going to take off, you better have a long runway. And what that meant, that had very strong implications, because we needed to be able to have enough money to last until the business looked real enough that it could attract more conventional investors. And we did not know how long that was going to take. So there were other angel investors who came in, and we did several small rounds of investment, small relative to other things that were going on. And it formed the base philosophy, which fortunately was consistent with Philip's approach, was to be quite frugal, if not outright cheap, and to see how few people it would take to get done what needed to be done. By contrast, at the same time we were raising and spending, I think it was $7 million, which is how much money was spent prior to the first big venture capital investment, Their.com was raising and spending approximately $70 million and burning through it. Came and gone, was well over 100 people. And I say this not to be critical. Doing companies is hard, and it's just not clear when you start what the right strategy is. But I would observe that as many or more startups wind up choking to death on too much money than starve for lack of it. And so the kind of frugality of Linden, and it did take three or four years to actually get something that had, you know, visible traction to anybody outside the hardest core of true believers. So that has proven to work out well. So part of what startups are supposed to be about in Silicon Valley is this, the great fortunes, whether it's the Scrooge McDuck with his pile of gold coins, or I don't know who these other guys are, but I understand that they're doing quite well. Personally speaking, the financial side of this is actually a byproduct of doing the right thing, doing it well, and adding value. And that's true whether it's the case of the company itself or the case of the many companies that are in process of starting and will start who are building on the Second Life kind of platform. That's my philosophy is be successful, add value, avoid this. There are many more ways to fail than there are to succeed. And a lot of managing this as an organization is really an understanding how to avoid failure. So it's not fundamentally a business talk, but I wanted to talk about that a little bit. And then now come back to Second Life in this larger context of disruptive technologies. I put some instances here of things that I've been involved with and some companies that I've been involved with. But I think what I want to do is to talk about all of these instances of disruptive technologies as new platforms and what their common characteristics are, and then illustrate that with a few stories. Okay. So the first thing, and I think this is the most major thing, is anytime you're involved with something that is radically new and disruptive, one of the major characteristics is going to be skepticism, or maybe I should say a struggle between faith and skepticism about this new thing. And the earlier it is, the more intense the struggle is, and the more pitched the battle is. So I can remember in 79, after I bought my Apple II and was starting to do some consulting with it, I went to business school very briefly for 6 months and dropped out. I was at MIT. The skepticism about the future of the PC was intense. These are useless toys that will never amount to anything because people had a very fixed idea that computers were these big things, expensive. They needed to be in special rooms with special, you know, air conditioning, and they needed to be able to crunch numbers. And there was not a mindset in the established world of computing that had any room for PCs. It turned out to be a blessing in disguise because it enabled a first generation of technologists, entrepreneurs, hobbyists, people who were bitten by the bug to do things without any adult supervision, without anybody to say, no, this was not possible, this will never work, you can't do that. And that was where the key innovations happened in the early days. The spreadsheet did not come out of anybody's R&D land. It was an inspiration of a single individual sitting in a classroom at Harvard Business. And I know the same thing is true of Second Life, and it is a recurring pattern. You can see the same pattern of skepticism with respect to the internet. I had the good fortune I was spending a lot of time in Washington, D.C. in the early 1990s. I co-founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and we were doing civil liberties work, trying to educate people and policymakers about the importance of maintaining openness and protecting privacy. And you know, our mantra was that the Bill of Rights in the U.S. extends out into cyberspace. As I was doing that, I intersected a transition in the internet, because it had been this Defense Department-funded research network, ARPANET, small, restricted just to, you know, major universities. But it was in the process of being taken out of the Defense Department, administered in a transitional period by the National Science Foundation with the intention of allowing commercialization of the internet, early 1990s. And in the same way that it is difficult to imagine a world without the net, I can tell you back then the idea that there would be a sort of a common information utility that you could just plug into that would support standard and interoperable protocols, that was just absurd. That was like ridiculous. There was nobody serious thought that was going to happen, not a single person. And collective amnesia aside, you can actually go back and you can Google a lot of the things that people were saying then, they're still there. I wound up getting involved with and investing in a company called UniNet, which was one of the first internet service providers, one of the first three that eventually became part of WorldCom and MCI. But in the early days, it was just UniNet, and you could call them up and they'd install an internet connection. I knew the big Silicon Valley VCs from my Lotus days, and I called my friend John Doerr from Klein & Perkins, sort of the premier Silicon Valley venture capitalist, and I said, interesting company, you should take a look at it. 1993, and it was too soon, and it was not interesting enough for him even to take a meeting to find out if there was an opportunity there. Now, we don't have to feel sorry for John. He did fine investing in Amazon and Netscape and other companies, and he's told this story on himself, so I'm not even embarrassing him. But the point is, the mindset wasn't there to understand the opportunity. The mindset was still about walled gardens, private networks, proprietary controlled consumer services that the phone companies are going to bring to us. That's what everybody was thinking, and it was of course ludicrously wrong. Okay. Last, very briefly, in the early 90s, mid-90s, I ran into the general counsel of the FCC at a conference, and I said, you know, by the way, people are streaming radio stations over the internet. And he'd never heard of it. And that is the general counsel, like the number two guy in the Federal Communications Commission. I said, better check this out. It could be important. So. So, in the history of Second Life, I've been through multiple waves of skepticism about it. It will never work. So Philip had this radical idea that hadn't been done before about having a scalable, infinitely scalable virtual world or worlds by centralizing the back-end storage of the objects and the terrain, and then streaming the geometry down to clients that were viewers, which it had just not been done that way. And a few technology people that looked at said, well, this isn't going to work. So that hurdle was overcome, or the existence proof was what they built in the first 6 months to show that that could actually work and it could scale. The business argument, people have tried these virtual worlds and they failed. And it was true that at that point, the roadside of the information superhighway was littered with the corpses of failed startups in this space. But people were not taking into account that the technology wasn't right, the preconditions for success in terms of the availability of broadband, sufficiently powerful personal computers to do, and so on and so forth. So, next thing we heard, there's no market for online games. Well, there's actually two things wrong with this. People had, and still have, enormous category trouble understanding that this is a world. That's the right metaphor. It's not a game. And I don't need to belabor this here. But in the earlier years, people would look at it and go, oh, these online gaming things, they've tried and they failed, and we're just not gonna go there again. So it was true believers at the beginning who were backing this. And one day, I can remember Philip coming in and saying, the users are going to create all the content. But there were no users. I don't even think we had the word residents. There was nobody there. It was this sort of blank, not very well terraformed. I don't know, it was probably four or six servers. And he said, the people, they're going to create the content. And I have to say, even I didn't understand what he was saying. But I believed him, because one of the things that I've learned is when you back an entrepreneur, you trust them, you give them the benefit of the doubt, you create conditions. When you do what I do, you try to create conditions that are going to be favorable for a successful experiment. Boy, is he right. Oh, is he right. Right, like by orders of magnitude. Okay. Today's skepticism about Second Life, and I hear this, and it's obviously not in this room or in the 40,000 people a day who are logging on, but it's in the next concentric circle out of people who are looking at this now, because it was on the cover of Business Week, and there's been this media explosion, and they're going, not for regular people. I don't know. I'd never use it. Now, I can't imagine, what would I do? You know, it reminds me of other things I've heard people say. 1995, I was showing people Amazon.com, which I love, order books, wow. And people go, I am never going to put my credit card onto the internet. Over my dead body. So we got over that one. And it's all about imagination. When people say, I just don't know what I'd use it for, the gap between their imagination about what they might do and their perception of what goes on isn't sufficiently close. But two things are happening. One is there's this enormous explosion of new stuff that's going on in Second Life. So the number of possibilities that become real on an almost daily basis is exploding and expanding. And the kind of knowledge and understanding that people have of it from their friends and from other media also grows dramatically. And so this, not for regular people, that's gonna go away. I absolutely guarantee it's gonna go away. It only looks like it's not gonna go away to some people. So my experience says, in the battle between faith and skepticism about these kinds of things, you don't have to take on faith that faith is going to win. There's lots of good empirical evidence from past waves that you can point to give you confidence, not absolute certainty, but confidence that the early stage that we're in now is in fact an early stage, and that we're going to see maturation, growth, further change. I'm gonna talk a little bit about that. But when we look at the future, something very important to keep in mind, it's a phenomenon identified, first described to my knowledge by a guy named Paul Saffo at the Institute for the Future. He calls it macromyopia. For people who are inside a new phenomenon, like Second Life, we tend to overestimate the short-term effects. We think more great things are going to happen sooner than they typically do. And conversely, we underestimate the long-term impact. People are not especially good at forecasting this. And so we might expect, what I would say is that certain situations that may be problematic or challenges in the short term may well take longer than anybody would like to fully resolve. Talk a little bit about that. On the other hand, it's very difficult to fully grasp and imagine what the long-term impact of Second Life and things like it are going to be. We have to stretch. We have to do some imaginative exercising to think about that. So in particular, in the short term, I think right now, there is still kind of a chasm between the power users and the clueless newbies. I mean, those are my terms, and they're slightly provocative terms, maybe not the best terms. It is just a fact. And there's still a significant number of people who come in, try it, and leave. It's not ready for prime time. And I don't believe that's going to change overnight. I believe it's going to change in stages. It's a little hard to know how quickly that's going to happen. But when people go, well, how long is it going to be before this is totally mainstream? I just go, well, not tomorrow, not next year. Coming. Okay. The other thing is, there are a variety of short-term issues, whether it's the stability of the grid. Is this thing down again? I understand it sometimes goes down and comes back up. And other infrastructure issues. Part of what I do, as a director, by the way, Philip and I get together periodically, and I try to emphasize a focus, which I think is really shared, about operationally keeping everything going. It's hard to do when you have hypergrowth, when you're doubling every 6 months or every 4 months. It strains every single system, both in the technical infrastructure to the accounting systems, and it requires a real dedication and focus operationally to build and grow the system so that there is the stability. And when a company is in a hypergrowth phase, which Linden is in now, they're going to continue to be, for the short and medium term, a variety of issues that kind of, they're rough edges issues, and I don't think they're going to go away. They need to be managed, and we need to make overall progress. On the other hand, in the long term, everybody's going to be in Second Life. If Second Life succeeds, and if the company doesn't succeed, it will be in a technological successor to it. So I'm not making the business forecast here about, I'm talking about as a phenomenon of a large shared virtual world where the residents create the content and the tools and there's an economy and that virtuality, snow crash made real. I had an unexpected spiritual experience two days ago, about this very thing. I was watching on YouTube the video of the Suzanne Vega performance she was doing with John Hockenberry on Infinite Mind, the NPR show. I'm watching them, and what I'm seeing is her avatar. She's playing guitar, and there's a live performance going on. I'm hearing it on my headphones because the audio is being streamed. But I'm watching a director cutting between multiple camera angles of a live concert. Now, I understand this is likely assembled in post-production, but there's no technical reason at all. Couldn't have been done live. And things like this will be done live. And I'm sitting thinking, well, wait a minute. What am I seeing here? Okay, there's a studio audience for this radio broadcast. The studio, though, is a virtual one, not a real one, because I'm watching as the camera pans around and it's looking at the residents who are there participating and being present in the concert. So I'm watching a kind of television broadcast of an event that is simultaneously real and virtual. And all of a sudden, my sense of what was real expanded a millionfold. The fundamental shift in my awareness happened. I got, at a really deep level, where this is going is in the full interpenetration of the terrestrial reality made up out of atoms and virtual realities made up out of bits. It's not a separate thing. It's not a cartoon. It's not a game. It's a much, 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 much unimaginably larger reality. And that is powerful. I came in today and I already learned a few things. The American Red Cross is setting up an office in Second Life, an actual office of the actual American Red Cross that will be staffed. Sorry? Cancer? I'm sorry. I got too excited. ACS, American Cancer Society. Thank you. Yes. But there'll be an office. Well, why is there an office? Because there are residents. There are people there who care about this. I think I heard that the Cancer Society raised $30,000. 40,000, thank you, from residents. When I heard about it, I go, well, that's kind of a one-time thing. Now I'm thinking, no, this is a real place for an appropriately expanded definition of reality. And of course, if you have a real-world organization, you want to have a presence. I knew about American Apparel and other things, but it's broader than that. It's universal. And Frieda, my wife, who's sitting here, said she saw someone's badge and it had a dog on it. And she asked, because we're dog people, is there an in-world dog park? Not yet. But I guarantee there will be. Everything we can imagine and things that we can't yet imagine from the real world will have their counterparts and their extensions, and it will all be interpenetrated. And it's a wonderful thing because there are many fewer constraints in Second Life than in real life. And it is potentially, at least, extraordinarily empowering. I want to talk just for a moment about the innovation aspect of this. The innovation in this world is going to be driven by the residents, not by the company. We know that, but it is worth repeating because this is a radical idea. The Wikipedia is driven by the same dynamic. And it sort of stands everything on its head, because the company, therefore, can't be, quote, in charge of what happens next. That does not leave room for the innovation of the community to think up new things and try things and take risks and succeed and fail and so on. The company's job has to be to facilitate the conditions for that innovation, in my view. Some of that is infrastructural. The grid has to be up, it has to, the performance needs to be reliable, good frame rates, all the things that we're very familiar with. No small undertaking, actually. The core capabilities of that system also have to continue to expand, especially to take advantage of Moore's Law and improve performance and, you know, in the underlying computing technology, but also to create the base capabilities that are needed to invent the new services and the new kinds of things. There's also a role in the overall management of the economy. I mean, one of the big bets, and I didn't mention this, but this is like so radical, as I think you know, to have a real economy where people, the residents, can own what they create and to have ways to make money off that in the real world, to support themselves on it. Economies, though, don't manage themselves. And there's some of the most interesting parts of board meetings are when we talk about the money supply and what policy do you set, how transparent are you, and how do you control the money supply to support growth and not have too much inflation, in other words, to create conditions for economic prosperity. And a final thing the company has to do, and I don't like the word social order, but I was running short on time. But there needs to be a kind of civil society, the equivalent of rule of law, sort of conditions so that people can come and do whatever their thing is without unwarranted interference. My vision is that over time, the governance and government of Second Life passes much more to residents and structures run and managed by residents or groups of residents. I'd like Second Life not to be in the business of being government, much less the business of being the police. I would say that's a large challenge to figure out how to do that. Nobody has ever done anything remotely like that I'm aware of. I think it will require a certain amount of experimentation. Probably some things will work, have worked better than others, some things will work better than others. But the future is going to be in a kind of world which is of, by, and for the people, the residents of it. And it will become increasingly indistinguishable from terrestrial reality. There will be a huge number of issues about what that means, as we try to sort out legal issues, and that's another whole talk. But there will be problems that will consume everybody's energy and attention that we cannot even articulate today. So, find the challenge. I think you are in a blessed position. You're the pioneers and the founders of this new world. You have unbelievably great opportunities to put your stamp, to leave a legacy, to create things which will endure and have value. The opportunity to participate in the creation of a new world is really a rare one, and so I hope you cherish it. And you'll face challenges. In every disruptive technology I've seen, there has always been a dynamic in which the early adopters begin to be pushed aside as the whatever it is begins to become mainstream. And there will be tensions as the frontier is civilized on all sides, of people who like it the way it is and people who want it to be what it might become. But the most important thing I want to say, and would like to leave you with, is with the privilege of creating a new world or new worlds, I believe comes responsibility. And really the responsibility is to make that new world a better place. There is no one vision or value of better place. It will be slightly different or maybe very different to different people. But in a new world free of a lot of the constraints that we're used to that empowers individuals, my hope is that Second Life will continue to be a world which is more inclusive than the terrestrial world, that provides opportunities for groups of people who are marginalized in the real world to be first-class citizens and residents. And we've already seen a number of fabulous things with different populations of the disabled and others. But I think it's still very early. I'm hoping that inclusiveness and Second Life being a level playing field for everyone remains and increases as a kind of a core value. And finally, I would just say, each of you, I hope, will think carefully about what a better world means to you. And as you go about your participation in Second Life, you do things, build things, interact in ways that furthers your own vision of that better world. Thank you very much.